welcome back to what we lovingly refer to as the Splash Podcast. And this is a very interesting part of the podcast, which we call In at the Deep End. I tell you, it's just... you see what we did there? What we have got is that we are going to speak to someone who had played the Splash Club, and we are going to go into a little bit more detail about the performances that happened at that rather wonderful venue. And this episode we have got the rather wonderful Mr. Andrew Cairns from Therapy, who was playing the Splash Club on the 19th of June 1995. Andy, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks very much, Dave, for having us on.
Mate, it's absolutely brilliant to speak to you. And we've also got Ben, who was, of course, the man who created the Splash Club. And he's going to ask the first question.
Hey there, how are you doing, David? All right?
I'm all right, sir. I'm all right. And I reckon if you ask this next question, and I promise that I'm not going to race you to give you the answer.
Yeah, I just thought it'd be very interesting to know just how did you get started with the whole Therapy band? You know, what was your start point, and what made you want to get that sound together in the first place? What was behind it?
Well, Therapy started by an accident. I'd always been in little bands growing up as a kid because I loved playing music. I played in this orchestra at school, I played trombone, I played bass in a couple of covers bands when I was 15 and 16. And I'd always wanted to do my own stuff, but I lived in a little market town outside Belfast, so I never thought I would get anywhere. Mm. And a friend of mine had gone to college at Jordanstown University, and he was in a band that was playing a charity raising gig, a fundraiser. And there was like 20 bands on it all over the university. And whenever I went to see them, there was a band called League of Decency playing. Mm. And they had that was all punk covers they played, like Dead Kennedys, The Damned, stuff like that. The drummer, this young drummer, was amazing. And I went up to him afterwards and said, oh, you know, I thought the band were really good, but I thought you were a fantastic drummer. His name was Five Ewing. And he said, yeah, it's just a pity we do a lot of cover versions. And I said, oh, yeah, well, what kind of music are you into? And he named a few bands that he was into that were quite similar to music I was listening to. And he said, well, do you play yourself? And I said, yeah, I play a bit of bass. And we found out that he lived about 9 miles up the road from me. So we just decided that we would meet up at his house. He lived with his dad, and his dad was out most of the day. And he had a room in his house with a little kit, and I had a little practice. And he said, look, well, my dad's at work. Why don't you come over a couple of times a week, and we can just have a jam, see what happens. So we took it from there. And we originally wanted a guitar player because I was a bassist, and we couldn't find one. So I switched to guitar. Fife was doing his A-levels at the time, and in one of his classes was a guy called Michael McKeegan, who was already in a band, a death metal band called Evil Priest, with his two brothers. And the thing that was good about Michael was, like myself and Fife, he had quite an eclectic taste. He wasn't just into one thing.
Right, yeah.
We invited him along to the Fife's house one day, and he really fit it in, and then we just took it from there. So that's how we kind of got together. Was if I hadn't been at that gig of my friends, I would have never seen League of Decency, and I'd have never met Fife. So it was a lucky break, really.
How did you come by the name?
Oh, the name?
Yeah.
When Therapy started, there was very long discussions about everything, whether it was the style of a song or what the guitar sound or the snare sound should be. And the band name, we wanted something that was very immediate. And we didn't really know, and we said, well, you know, the music's quite cathartic. We wanted something like The Who, that was really, or The Jam, something that was really, really straightforward. And we said that, you know, we had one practice once, whenever we started rehearsing in a rehearsal space in Rathcoole on the outskirts of Belfast, it was the first time we got out of Fife's room, so we could turn the music up as loud as we wanted.
Yeah.
And it was very cathartic. You know, we had the stacks blasting, and he could drum and hit the snare as loud as he could. And Therapy, I remember dropping him back off, and somewhere on the drive from Rathcoole to Larne, where Fife lives, we said, well, Therapy's a pretty straightforward name. I think it's pretty similar in most languages, or a deviation of the syntax. You know, it's quite similar. And we thought, well, let's live with it. And then the next day, I think he rang me up and said, the more I think about that name, it's a better name. So that's how it came about.
And who insisted on the question mark?
that was, I mean, the true story about that. There's been, we've had fun with that over the years. It's a really simple thing. We used to do a lot of gigs around Belfast, and one of the gigs we were playing was for an anarchist collective called Warzone, who very kindly put us on in the early days a few times. And they said to us once, look, can you design the poster? What you do is you'd send them an A4 sheet of paper. They would Xerox 100 of them and plaster them all around Belfast city centre. Yeah. And I started therapy. Do you remember a thing called Leprosep?
Yeah.
I'm showing my age now. This was before everyone had a printer at home. So we got some Leprosep and we were going to write therapy, I think it was the Connor Hall we were playing in Belfast. And I put the name of the band far too far over to the left, and it looked really odd. And I just said, well, why don't I put a question mark in to give it a bit of symmetry and balance? So we put that up there, and we just handed it in, and everyone went, what was the question mark about? And I told them, so they thought it was funny. And then we were going to do another set of flyers for another gig, and I remember handing it in to someone, and they went, oh, no question mark this time. So we sort of thought, it had come a bit of a thing already. We'd only released one, we hadn't even released anything. We'd only done a handful of gigs. So before we even had any gigs done, we added the question mark in it. I mean, it did cause us all kinds of problems. I mean, so as you can imagine, in the early days, it was like, are they playing or not? It was like people were would see the poster. And go, yeah, mate, are them ones there? Your man with the hair and the beard and the big skinny drummer, are they playing in there or what? Because they just saw the poster.
Listen, let's go forward to, as I say, the 19th of June, 1995, when... I mean, with therapy playing there, it was a little bit different, because obviously when we had bands like Oasis, or if we had Supergrass, or if we had Gene, or if we had Ocean Colour Scene, they were all bands who were on the rise. But therapy were, in 1995, it was the week after you just released the Infernal Love album. You're a very, very big band. You later on in the Infernal Love tour, you played at Brixton Academy and two nights at Shepherd's Bush Empire. What was it that you were going to play the Splash Club? What was the reason for playing such an intimate venue?
Well, I think for a start, we were very familiar with it because we knew you were there and you'd invited us to so many shows. So we loved it. And we absolutely loved playing there. And we loved playing there that night, but we loved going there. It was just always, we used to meet a lot of our friends. I mean, as you remember yourself, we used to go there just for a drink on occasion. Even we would meet in the bar at the front and have a drink and then pop in and see the band, even if it was someone we'd never heard of. And I think the thing about therapy is because people always seem to think that therapy started with Trouble Gum, but we had two independent albums and a major label album before that, and to be honest, on those, the first two and a half years of touring were all done in very small punk venues. And none of those venues had the history of the Splash Club to start with anyway. So it was, for us, we almost felt like it was an honour to do this album there because it was just such a legendary club. I'll be honest, the only people that complained weren't myself. I've met was a bloody crew. They were going, the album's in the top 10. Why are we playing this place?
Dirtbirds, the lot of them, yeah, Andy. Dirtbirds, the lot of them. Yeah. Can you remember any of the shows that or any of the bands that you saw play there?
There's quite a few. I remember going to see The Almighty, which I really, really liked. And I knew Ricky really well. And I remember it was just carnage because I think at that point in time, there was people living upstairs and stuff like that in the house. And I felt really sorry for them because they were trying to get on with their day. And I think, Ricky and Pete and Floyd and Stumpy were all running about the place, and it was just carnage. And I think it was almost like trying to round up kittens, trying to get them all together in the same place.
I tell you what, Andy, see some of the nights that we had up there. I tell you, literally, let me tell you, I was a young man at the time, and some of the nonsense and quackery that went on up in that room. And of course, but Ben, you would never indulge in such things. Bullshit. Listen, let me ask you another question, Andy, is of that actual concert and what you can remember. I remember being at the Jerry, Therapy's manager, had let me away from the T-shirt booth, and I was actually doing sort of like on-stage sort of security, and it was absolutely bonkers because it was, it was however many people were in there, all going absolutely mad, jumping up and down, going crazy. Yeah. Can you remember anything about the set list? I mean, obviously, Infernal Love had just been released. Can you remember what sort of songs you were playing at that time?
Yeah, I remember we did, like, Stories and we did Loose. But the one thing that really sticks out for me, there was a... we were very self-conscious about this. There was a song on the album called Moment of Clarity, and for better or for worse, it was our first... I mean, it could even be called a ballad. You know, it's a very melancholy song, and it was very slow, and it was a very quiet start with just voice and guitar. And then it went bombastic, and then it went quiet again. And we'd never done anything like that before. Well, you know, arguably, as you know, we'd done things which were quiet, but we'd never done anything that was verging on rock ballad. And I remember when we did it, you know, we were very self-conscious that a band like us had done this, and we thought, well, can we pull it off? Now, obviously, as the bit Infernal Love tour we went, we played that song live every night, and it was done, you know, with a huge big neon heart and all this. But the real test of it would have been in front of like 200 people, where literally their noses were a foot from your guitar.
Of course. Mm.
So yeah, I remember before going, I remember saying, should we do this song? Because it might backfire, you know, because people are there to jump up and down. They're here to hear Stories, Knives, Scream, To Die Laughing, Teeth Grinder. If we play a 4.5 minute ballad, it might be, anyone fancy a pint? And I just thought, so we were kind of
room.
But the thing is, so Andy, and one of the things that I've always been fiercely proud of Therapy, I've been proud of Therapy for two reasons. Number one is, you know, the band this year, 2020, the band are celebrating 30 years as a band. They never split up. Trends came and went, and they never split up, and they kept on going, releasing music, and which I think is brilliant. But the other thing was, and especially around the Infernal Love album, is that Therapy would take risks. You know, you were saying a moment of clarity, songs like that, which were so different and so not used. I think Therapy need to be congratulated by taking risks when they were at the absolute height of their success. Not many bands would have done that.
Oh, thanks, Dave. Now, I do think that because we did that, we always were around. I had a really good discussion with Paul Bolton, who's been our agent since 1992. He still is, and he's at X-Ray touring. And I remember talking to him, and he said, well, there's two-way bands do it. He said, you can give the punters what they want. And he said, there's only a couple of bands can do that for years and years. Like, example, AC/DC can do that. They can become a stadium band and stay at that level, doing exactly the same record again and again. He said, with most bands, however, there's only a certain amount of tolerance for that. And he said, what most bands do is they make two or three albums that sound the same, and they get to, for example, Brixton-sized venues, Wembley Arena-sized venues, and then they split up. And then what happens is when they come back again 5 years later, they're still playing Wembley Arena because they've become legendary and they mean a lot to people. Mm. Or you can do what we do. You can kind of, our attendances dip and then rise and then dip and then rise. And, you know, I was talking to him, but he said, you know, if you'd have split up after Infernal Love at Brixton Academy and come back in 2004, you'd have been coming back to Brixton Academy. He said, in the business, they call it the freeze effect. That's just the way it works. Mm. But he said, then again, you know, you have music in your blood. You would have had 8 years of what the fuck do I do? You know, you know, in various side projects and ill-advised, you know, interpretive dance and the stuff like that. And I think with...
I wonder who'd have done the bloody interpretive dance. I reckon he'd have probably had me up. Listen, I'm going to ask a question of both of you now, right? Because obviously I'm not the musician. I'm the... I was the roadie, or I was the stage manager and stuff. But you both played the Splash Club, you know, in the mid-90s. You did it with a couple of bands, Ben and Andy obviously did it with Therapy. Mm. But what did you think of the music scene at that time? Because obviously we were just about entering the Britpop or the Brit Rock years, stuff like that. What did you think of the music scene at that time?
Shall I go in there quickly? Just as a thought, just to cap that, is I was looking at this earlier on, and I see that the Therapy show was as you said, was about the 19th of June. I mean, looking at it around that time, for instance, if I look at June, you know, we had on like we had the Muffs on the 3rd. We had Sponge over from America. We had Whale. Do you remember them? With
Great band.
Slow Bo Humping Hobo Babe, and Tricky supported them. I remember having to. He refused to go on without a big bag of weed. So I had.
I had to
coordinate assisting the great man with his necessary juice power, but
at least we're in King's Cross. You didn't have to go too far anyway.
and then you had like Cooler Shaker played a couple of days before, you know, before the therapy show, and then the day after. You had someone like Khalifs, you know, kind of early days rapping stuff going on. So it was a really eclectic sort of stuff going on, you know?
Because I think, you know, the whole of the Brit rock sort of thing, it was quite wide ranging, Andy. And I think that, you know, if you look, actually, you know, 1994, 1995, if you look at the bands that Therapy had supporting them, you had Credit to the Nation, you had Curb Dog, you had Honeycrack, you had Grant Hart from Husker Du, you had all these different types of things. I mean, do you look back on that time and think it was a wonderful golden age for British music?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, there was a lot of, I think 90s was the rise of eclecticism in music for the good. You know, you think of it, for example, the first time we played Donington in 1994, there was a big discussion among friends of ours in the metal fraternity that said, well, the band with short hair, this could go wrong because bands with short hair don't play Donington. And then you'd us in Helmet and Faith No More had short hair. And now if you look at something like Download now, the majority of the bands have short hair. It's only at something like Bloodstock that you'll see a ton of bands with waist length hair. But I mean, I think the 90s were a lot of that startup because people were like Cooler Shaker, you know, like Husker Du. You know, Husker Du were taking the Beatles and mixing it with Black Flag. Cooler Shaker were taking the Indian rhythms and mixing that with, you know, psychedelia. And then there was, like Ben said, there was someone like Tricky who was doing almost like a punk version of trip hop. A band like Whale that were an incredible pop band that were mixing, you know, hip hop beats with like noise rock guitars.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that was definitely the decade where people started not being as tribal. You know, before that, there was like, you were a goth, you were a Grebo, you were a punk rocker, you were a Teddy Boy, you were a mod, etc. But in the 90s, you know, even starting as early back as things like Pop Lead itself, you know, people started mixing and matching genres. Yeah, and that's really fed into music in the current climate.
Did you think that had an impact on you, you know, being able to pick up, you know, audiences from different genres, if you like, you know?
Yeah, Ben, I think it did. And I also think it helped. We came from Northern Ireland, which was tiny. And what it meant was a lot of bands were, during the Troubles, they were terrified to come and play Northern Ireland. They would go and play Dublin and Cork, but they'd swerve past Belfast. And you know, and I don't blame them because they were very intense times. But what that meant was that people like myself, Michael and Fife, we would go and see everybody. So, you know, we would go and see the Sugar Cubes one week. We'd see the Communards the next week. Simple Minds, the Human League. But we'd also go and see, you know, Jane's Addiction, if they played, we would go and see the Jesus and Mary Chain. So it meant that we were very, very open-minded musically. So, you know, we would drag along, you know, I remember Fife dragging me along to see a band called The House of Love.
Yeah.
An indie band that in a million years I wouldn't have liked.
Yeah, I remember.
But I went to see them live and they were amazing. Same with a band called Ride. Did you remember them?
Absolutely.
Yeah, great band. And I was never a fan because I thought they were a bit too, I don't know, maybe a bit too bland for me. And then I went to see them live, and it was Michael of all people brought me along, and I thought it was incredible. And you know, I remember taking Fife along to see the Sugar Cubes, and he loved it. So it was, you know, we were very, very open-minded. And then also stuff like, you know, when I grew up, I believe it or not, I never really liked metal. I think the only metal album I owned was No Sleep to Hammersmith. And Michael, when he joined the band, you know, he gave me a really good education in Voivod and all these bands. But yeah, that was, I mean, somewhere like the Splash Club was perfect for, you know, going to see lots. I actually remember seeing a guy, one of the best gigs I ever saw at Splash, actually, was a guy called Zan Lyons. And
who?
There was a double bill. It was Fault Line and Zan Lyons. And they were friends of Alec Empire from Atari Teenage Riot.
Yeah.
That's where I'd heard of it. And they put it on at Splash Club. And Fault Line was just one guy on a laptop. And the opening act was a young guy called Zion Lyons, and it was him and a computer. And I remember whenever they set up, I thought, this is going to be bizarre, because, you know, the room was like pretty full, but he was incredible. And just the noise he made, you didn't care that it was just a guy on a keyboard and a laptop on stage. He had the lights really, really low and these incredible sounds coming out of the PA.
Yeah. Obviously one thing that happened with you, Andy, is that after Splash Club days, you know, you did actually come back to the Water Rats, you know, and he ended up recording a live album in that same room, you know, and played there 3 nights, and you know, it was absolutely brilliant. And I remember the dressing room. Ben's got a fantastic picture of Beck when he's in that dressing room.
And, oh, really? Wow!
Because when Beck played there, but I remember it, and that night it had that's where the mixing desk was and everything, wasn't it? And all that.
Yeah.
What are your memories of recording a live album at the Water Rats?
Well, we were very fortunate because everyone at the Water Rats let us in very early. I mean, we were bringing in some recording gear with us, and we had to make sure we set it somewhere because we knew that the punters would be rammed. We had to set it somewhere there where, you know, any dancing or, you know, we would knock it over. And I remember the venue let us in really early in the morning the first day. I mean, they let us in, you know, stupidly early, so that we could go in and set all the recording gear up. And then I remember we spent all day. I mean, the first gig, I think we had no support bands for it. I think with Dave McPherson did a few of the gigs.
That's right, from Inmate. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. But there was no amps or anything on the stage, just our own. And I remember we spent the entire first day getting the sound right. And then after that, we stayed in a hotel just behind the venue. And it was really, really good fun. And the good thing about that was we didn't get cabin fever. You know, we thought if we're going to be around this venue for 4 days and doing 3 shows, we might get a bit, you know, jaded, or we might get a bit fed up. But it was incredible. And every day was I can remember every day was a different kind of show.
I've always thought one of the greatest things about that was that wee cheeky fella who came on before you to gee the crowd up each night, you know.
Oh yeah, whatever happened to him?
Whatever happened to him? I'd say if you actually go into the Water Rats and the Splash Club, and if you close your eyes and just really concentrate, you can actually still hear me being booed with the crap jokes that I was telling. Now listen,
that was Dave McPherson. It was still booing him and on and on.
Absolutely. Listen, what we've got 2020, it's a big year for Therapy. We don't know what's going to happen, you know, later on in the year, but there is still hopefully going to be a Therapy 30th anniversary European tour happening later on in the year. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking. I mean, when does this podcast go out?
Well, we're not quite sure yet, so it'll probably be going out in the next sort of 2 months.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, so now, I mean, I'm talking to you now, and I would say from what we know is it doesn't look very like we will be doing any shows at the very, very latest until December. So December 2020. I know that a lot of the bigger shows in Europe have actually already been moved to April 2021.
Right.
That's, you know, and we don't have the definite dates, but it was just that's what's happened. But it's not us. We know that everybody is in the same boat, and I've been talking to people in other bands. But I mean, we will be doing those 30th anniversary shows because we released that sort of celebration album. You know, if anyone's bought a ticket to see us play our greatest hits and have a brilliant night, I don't want them to turn up and have, you know, my new jazz direction. You know, I think if you paid your money to get, like, you know, the hits and more, that's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Andy, tell me this. We'll leave it now with, I wonder if you could tell us, you know, we're talking an awful lot about the 1990s. And I wonder if you could maybe come up with a list of records that you think sum up that sort of time when Therapy and the Splash Club was sort of happening. So sort of that mid-90s bit. What are the songs that come to your mind?
Well, there's, I mean, if ones I always remember here in the Splash Club, you know, there was always people like, I remember Oasis getting played there a lot because that's where they started.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite Oasis songs is Acquiescence. And the first time I heard that was in the Splash Club. And I thought, I remember, you know, because it was a B-side, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember going, this is not definitely maybe, you know, what's this? And I knew that nobody else with our group or our tech knew much about Oasis. You know, they were also rock fans. And one guy that worked with us, Willie, he was Scottish. And I remember saying, what is this? It sounds really like Oasis. Have the rip-off band started already? And he went, no, it's Oasis. This is a B-side called Acquiescence. And that's the first time I heard that was in the Splash Club. I remember that really, really well. And
yeah, because we used to get, we were on the mailing list for a lot of the DJ lists. So we used to get, like, you know, advanced copies and 12s and stuff like that coming in. And we used to make, back then, we used to make compilation tapes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Those were the days. You know, was there any of the sort of, you know, bands like, you know, we mentioned, you know, you've got your Reefs, your Skunk Anansies, you know, bands. Were there any of the bands that played the Splash at that time that you were a particular fan of?
Oh, yeah, no, we all love Skunk Anansie. I mean, we like Reef a lot as well. You know, we got to see them on the festival circuit as well as down there. I remember going to, you remember you took me once to see Skunk Anansie in the Splash?
Yes,
and,
yes.
And I remember really liking them. And I remember me and you and Ace went out for a night on the town after the gig.
Lovable rogue.
Yeah, and soon after that, we ended up, you know, they came on tour with us as well. But, you know, I'd have really got, and some of their brilliant songs, like Week and things like that, are just, you know, just incredible songs from the time. And every time I hear those songs, I just think back to that time. You know, it's funny because a lot of the songs from the 90s I can hear, and I've almost been overexposed to them, and they just don't mean anything to me. But something like when I hear, especially early Skunk Anansie records, because it's a very British thing as well, you know, because a lot of the 90s was about big American bands and, you know, Nirvana or whatever. And,
yeah.
And Eels and bands like that. But whenever I hear Skunk Anansie, it's very, very, to me, it's always a very British thing. And, you know, it always brings me back to that part of London and a certain group of people hanging out and getting on. And that's what I did like about the Splash Club is everyone was friendly from going into the door to hanging out. You know, it was one of the few places in London. We used to have this joke, you know, because Alan Partridge used to say that London and stuff like that. And, you know, we were in London an awful lot, and I love London. I always have done. But the music business, you know, we were talking earlier about the eclecticism, but, you know, there wasn't half a lot of knobheads in the music business in the 90s, you know, because all these blokes with a lot of money and too much money and little sense signing a lot of crap. And what I liked about the Splash Club was it seemed to be a haven from that. And there was none of that there. And everyone, you know, you could go into the bar, and I struck up so many conversations with strangers in that place. And that's whenever I hear Skunk Anansie, it always reminds me of that kind of mentality.
Please get in touch with us at splashclubtv@gmail.com and see us on the Facebook, facebook.com/thesplashclub. Have a great day.